I appreciate one of the sentiments that Gary made in his prayer. And he talked about that we are striving to be like what we read in the New Testament. Our responsibility when it comes to being the Lord's church is not to determine in our own thinking what would be best and how we can best do things, but rather we need to make sure that all that we do is done according to God's will. And so I think it's really important that we keep that focus in mind. One of the reasons that it's so, I think, so incredibly important to study from the book of Acts is because the book of Acts does have the so much about the beginning of the church and what the church looked like and what we are to do and how we are to act. And so if we have any questions about, should we be doing something as the Lord's church, or should we not be doing something as the Lord's church? We can look to Scripture for those examples to see what we ought to do. And so that's, I think, a good part of what comes out of the book of Acts. And so certainly a good thought to open us with in our prayer. We are in Acts chapter 7. I thought I saw somebody. In my peripheral vision, I thought I saw somebody already raising their hands, and I'm going, well, that was quick. Waving isn't the same thing, Diane. Diana. All right. So in Acts chapter 7, as we look at the beginning of this chapter, we kind of looked backwards just a smidge. And what we find is that we've seen the seven men who were chosen to serve because there was a need that was not being met. Stephen then later accused of being guilty of blasphemy, defended himself, and of course, the scripture tells us that we haven't gotten there yet. We're kind of getting there in tonight's lesson. We're gonna start listening to what Stephen has to say. Stephen begins his defense and addresses and so that's where we start with verse one. Now, if you'll notice, some of the chapters are short, and so there's a lot more. The questions are spaced a little bit closer together as far as what verses we're going to. You'll notice that there are, what is it, 60 verses in this chapter, and we're still doing it in just two pages. So that means there's a lot of stuff in the lesson in the text that wasn't necessarily covered in depth. And so if you see something in the text that you want to talk about, bring it up. That's, as I said, from the beginning of this class, my material is not intended to be the be all end all of perfect class material, but rather its design and its purpose is to help us get to a point of having good discussion. So if there's something you'd like to discuss that I don't ask a question about or to flesh it out a little further than I do, feel free to do that. But as we begin in Acts chapter 7, beginning at verse 1, we see Stephen addressing, he's going to make an address, and his address is based on the question that comes from the high priest. And the high priest asks the questions, are these things so? So I would ask you, what was he challenging? What was he asking about when he said, are these things so?
Yes.
Well, it's not arm wrestle. Let's just have an answer. Okay. What'd you say?
The blasphemy.
The blasphemy. Okay. Is that what you were going to say, Monique? I saw your hand. Okay. Mike, were you going to add anything to that? Okay.
The accusation.
I'm really sorry. What?
The accusation against.
Right. The accusations against Stephen. So that, and that further. Okay. So I was going to take Diane's question and take it just a step further. Mike did that for us. What blasphemy accusations? The accusation that Stephen had committed blasphemy. By the way, remind us, what two things were they charging Stephen of blasphemy against?
Moses.
Moses, which represented the law, and God, right? And so it's kind of an interesting thing, because their accusation against him regarding Moses was, you're saying that Moses' law is no longer, I'm going to paraphrase very quickly. This obviously isn't the words that Stephen said, but essentially what you're saying is, you're talking about Jesus and the new traditions and the new things that he's bringing in and how he's taken out the old law and, the temple, he's going to tear it down in 3 days and build it up, all these kind of things. And so when they saw that, of course, if they recognize that what they recognize that Moses as being a great prophet, as a great man, we talked about it on Sunday morning when I talked about the Mount of Transfiguration, that it was Moses, Elijah, and Jesus who were shown to the disciples. And then while they were, Peter starts to speak up. Oh, this is great. Let's build a temple to all three. And while he's speaking, the cloud overshadows. And when the cloud is taken away, Jesus is the only one left there. And they hear the voice from heaven, God saying, "This is my son, hear him." And so the idea behind that very clearly, God is saying, yes, Moses and Elijah were important and they did a part that was really important. And if you go to Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7, Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, it starts with, "I didn't come to destroy the old law, I came to fulfill it." So everything that we see Jesus doing, they should recognize as a continuation of what they've been part of for all these generations, and yet somehow they can't see that. Monique, then Dan.
Asking, I really think so. What are you teaching about Moses and God?
Yeah, what? Well, and I think it's, I yes, we could say. That's another side to look at. One thing he could be, are the blasphemies true? Or he could be saying to Stephen, the things that you're saying about God and Moses, tell me more about them so I can understand them. Tell me what you're teaching.
Tell them what they are, and then we'll stop you.
Yeah, tell us what you believe so then we can stone you with cause. Yeah, there you go. All right, Dan and then Gary.
They're also upset that Stephen, we see in verses 13 and 14.
Of Acts chapter 6.
Yes.
Okay, going back to Acts chapter 6, Dan says, let's look at 13 and 14.
So he mentions, never ceases to speak words against this holy place and the law.
Right.
And they seem to be upset about this holy place,
Yeah.
suggesting the temple, the physical
Right.
temple. And then it talks about, we have heard him say that this Jesus of Nazareth will destroy this place and will change the customs that Moses delivered to us.
Right.
And this turns out to be foundational to Stephen's argument. If you go into chapter 7, verse 48, yet the Most High does not dwell in houses made by hands, as the prophet says, heaven is my throne and earth
Okay.
is my footstool. So part of Stephen's argument is, don't obsess about this physical building, because Jesus is showing us that, for one thing, that the temple is us.
So I want to explore that, but before I do, I want to come and find out what Gary had. What were you going to hand?
I was just going to say that when you ask them, is this true? It's more like what we would think when you go into a courtroom case, like, how do you plead?
Right.
Guilty or not guilty,
That's a
that's.
great way of looking at it. Right. The judge says, do you plead guilty or not guilty? If you plead guilty, that changes the whole discussion, doesn't it? But yeah, so effectively the high priest is asking, are you guilty of what we're saying? And explain this. That's a good point, Gary. Did you have more? Okay. All right. I want to go back to what Dan was saying for just a minute. And now that Gary sidelined me a little bit, I'm going to have to try and regather my thoughts here. When we think about the temple, what did the temple represent to the people?
It's God's place.
Okay, it was God's. We know that the in the Holy of Holies, the probably the main focal point of the Holy of Holies was the mercy seat, and it had the cherubim with their wings outspread over covering that, and the mercy seat represented God's seat among them. Now, do we really think that a physical God sat on, I mean, sorry, a spiritual God sat on a physical throne? No, but it was a representation of the throne of God. God has given many, many word pictures and many, many visualizations for us to see to help to understand him. When we recognize God as a king, then a king should sit on a throne, and the mercy seat would represent, in a sense, that kind of a throne. Now, Dan talked about the fact that the temple and it being that dwelling place of God's. So why is it such a big deal that he's talking about tearing down the temple and building it up. Well, if they're thinking about the physical temple, number one, as big as it was, it would have been a monumental task to tear it down in 3 days. But an impossible task, human speaking, an impossible task would have been to build it up. When he said he was going to tear down this temple and build it up in 3 days, what was he talking about?
Body.
Okay. Jesus' body. Okay. So why does Jesus equate his body to the temple? Why does he say we're going to tear down this temple? Why doesn't he just say, I'm going to go to the cross and die? Why does he specifically say we're going to tear down this temple?
In 3 days, he resurrected. And the pattern for us is that we're to be resurrected in such a way that God moves within us.
Okay, so Dan is saying that he was resurrected, and when we're resurrected to the new life, the burial in the watery grave of baptism, raised to that new life, that God then dwells within us. That's a very good point, Steve.
He's going to be ushering in a new kingdom.
Okay, he's off. Let's modify that statement just a little bit. Same kingdom, a new dispensation of that kingdom, but yes. Okay. And so he's ushering in this new phase of the kingdom. And so why is it important that he talks about tearing down the temple?
Being carried down the old law. I'm not
Okay.
sure. I'm scared.
Okay. So Gene says, is it tearing down the law?
They can't go through.
Okay. Essentially, those two points come together into the point that I'm trying to make. Monique said, are we talking about the law? What the temple represented was old form worship, that they had to bring the people had to bring their sacrifices to the priest. The priest then took them in and made the sacrifice. The high priest was the only one who was able to go into the Holy of Holies, first to make sacrifice for sin for himself and then for the people. And so what he says is, I'm going to tear down the system, if you will, of religion that you've been a part of, this system of the priesthood and the bringing the sacrifices. And I'm tearing down that middle wall of partition. I'm breaking down that barrier between God and man. I'm bringing it into place. And he says, I'm going to tear down this place, not literally the walls of the temple, but I'm going to tear down what goes on here, and I'm going to raise it up in 3 days. And the new temple that will be raised up in 3 days is effectively Jesus, his kingdom. And so the kingdom no longer has a physical seat on earth, but rather a spiritual seat in Christ in heaven. And so I want us to get that, because they were all they could see, all that the people could see then was the fact that they could only see the temple itself and what the temple represented and how that represented their worship and the systems of sacrifice and all the things that went along with that. And so bottom line is, they had to say, we've got to realize this whole system is being taken out of place, because the new what okay, remember what he says in Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7 again. He makes a comparison to the physical nature of the old law. You've heard it said to those of old, but now I say, don't lust, don't commit adultery. Now I say, don't lust, don't murder a man. Now I say, don't even be angry. And some of those kinds of things. So as we think about that's where the priests and the Jews and the Sadducees and the Pharisees and all that are upset, because they're saying, you're taking away all of our traditions. But they should have expected that, because for generation after generation after generation after generation, they were looking for what? The Messiah. And Jesus is the Messiah. And now things have to change. And they're going, huh. You let me use the phrase economy. What's going to happen to the economy of Israel? The economy of Israel rotated, was centered on the temple. Now what? Okay.
Especially the Levites.
Especially the Levites, right? Does that mean we got to go get a job? Okay. We don't talk about some of those aspects, but there's a lot of implications to taking out the old system of worship and bringing in the new that we don't necessarily see at first glance. That's why I want us to dig into it a little bit deeper and really get that. So the priests, yeah, damn.
The Jews should have anticipated
Yeah, the Jews
something
should have
like
been, yeah.
Jesus coming. There's probably many places, but one comes to mind in Daniel 9:25.
Daniel 9:25.
Build therefore and understand that from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem to the coming of an anointed one, a prince.
Okay, so in Daniel chapter 9, verse 25, it talks about the coming of the anointed one till the Messiah. The New King James just uses the word Messiah, where yours calls refers to it as the appointed. When you're reading the English Standard, aren't you, Dan?
Yes.
Yeah. And we know that the anointed one or the Messiah is talking about the same person, right? So we say that. So from the so to restore and build Jerusalem until the Messiah comes.
And then,
And when the Messiah comes, the anticipation should be that things are going to be different.
verse 26, that people in the place who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary.
Yeah. Yeah, and people from the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end of it shall be with flood and so on and so forth. By the way, was there ever a physical destruction of that of what we're talking about, the patterns and the things? Yes, Dan says yes. What?
Sin.
In approximately 70 AD when Jerusalem fell. And that is one of the, and by the way, I think that Jerusalem falling in 70 AD was very much a part of God's plan, because what did Jerusalem hold? All the birth records, all the lineages and all those things. And so we can't today say, oh, I'm going to trace my lineage and I'm going to go marching back through and I'm going to march through my lineage until I can get all the way back to Jerusalem. And then I'm going to go to Jerusalem and find out, should I have been a Levite or should I have been a Benjamite, or what should I have been? And so with those records being gone, nobody can do those things, and that makes us fall back on being what?
Dependent on God.
Dependent on God and therefore his children through the new covenant. Yes, very good.
Well, you mentioned, looking at the economics that we don't really see at first glance.
Right.
It's possible, doesn't say anywhere, but it's possible that could have been a reason why they were looking for a physical kingdom,
Well, sure it
just
was.
assuming that we're just going to be gobbled up and become servants or,
Right.
leaders in the kingdom.
Right. If this kingdom disappears, what are we? Who are we? Whose allegiance do we have? Who's going to support us? Where, all the things. And that's why, we think of, the economy of Israel, and the economy isn't just money. That's the totality of, their system of government and their monetary sources. And the, think of all the, if the old law is done and there's no longer the daily sacrifices and those things, where does the money come to support the temple itself? Where does the money come to support the Levitical tribe? Where does all that stuff go? It's interesting that scripture doesn't spend a lot of time discussing that, does it? It just says it's done. And now there's this new system in Jesus. Okay. All right. Very good. So that brings us all the way to question number two. Stephen reviews how the history of Israel. How did God tell Abraham that he would inherit the land? And by the way, I'm not looking for the land, nation, and seed promise going back to Genesis chapter 12, verses 1, 2, and 3. We know that that's the promise, but what method does God then say this is going to be accomplished by, is effectively kind of what we're asking there. And we can get most of that answer out of verses 6 and 7. By the way, let's pause for just a minute. We're jumping through quite a bit of text here. And in that section between verses 2 and 6, verses the end of verse 2 and into 3, 4, and 5, he tells that history, how Abraham was in Mesopotamia and he lived in the area of Haran, and God says, get up and go. And he got up and he went, and God says, go and go away from the land that you know and the people that you know. And I'm going to take you to a place that you've never seen, but I'm going to show it to you. That's all in verse 3. And so he comes to the land of Canaan, and he dwells in there, and dwelt in Haran. And from there, when his father was dead, he moved them to this land in which you now dwell. And God, and there was no inheritance. And so he's going through all the biblical history that we can read in much of our Old Testament, but this is stuff they would have known. And Stephen, why does Stephen go through all of that? What would be the reason of reciting Israel's history?
Because they looked at Abraham as their father. That
Okay.
was kind of their beginning. But even all the way back to this time, every time an important place and time came, that history was retold over again.
Yes, we see this history told several times. This is similar to the history that we read about, and it's a different history, but it's similar to the recounting of history that Peter gives in his sermon on Acts chapter 2. And we see it in various places where these histories are brought up because heritage is important to them, and he's wanting to point to them. Oh, I saw a hand over here before. Okay. Before he says,
Earth.
oh, sorry.
This is Stephen's attitude to convince people to work. You start with what you
I'm the last. Start with what you agree. Okay, right. So he's saying, I want you to understand, we have common ground. We all know where we came from, but we also need to understand where that was intended to bring us. Everything that we've known for all of these generations was meant to bring us to this time, is what effectively the message of Stephen is. And by the way, not just Stephen, the rest of the apostles as well, isn't it? So as we think about that, he's trying to show them that. And so we come down to verse 6 and it says, but God spoke in this way. And so that's the question that I have in the second question. How did God tell Abraham that he would inherit the land?
spoken.
Okay, he spoke it. That's a good answer. That's correct. In other words, he gave it to him. It was a verbal thing. What's that? Through a vision. Okay.
A different answering a different the different verse.
Okay, go ahead.
How did he say he was going to inherit verse 5 through his descendants? It even happened.
Okay, through his descendants, and that goes back up into verse 5. And again, we need to pick up the context. I saw Susan, then Christy. Okay, then Christy. All right. I may need to work.
Sure.
Okay. Dan? Okay. I'm sorry. Were you done?
No.
Oh, well, no, I didn't. I'm having a hard time with the air conditioning. I'm sorry.
Sorry. What answer you are looking for, what way
Okay.
it's worded.
Okay. We'll come to that in just a moment. Dan?
Genesis chapter 15 is this very detailed vision that God gave Abraham, where he had him lay out animal sacrifices, and he had a flaming pot floating between them. It got dark, and Abraham was promised. Well, God described for him all the things that were going to play out over the next 400 some years.
Right.
And it's not a very pleasant vision,
No, it's not.
but it was going to end with Abraham's descendants, many, many generations afterwards, inheriting a lot of land.
Okay.
And this comes right after chapter 14, where Abraham had been a general who defeated
You're
multiple
talking about
kings.
Genesis 14.
In Genesis chapter 14,
Yes.
as a general, he defeated many kings and yet did not take any spoils of land
Right.
from them.
Okay, very good. Let me just make a comment real quick and then I'll come to you. So I know I pointed to verses 6 and 7, but again, we pick up the context in 5 and 6, and in verse 5 as well. So think about this kind of the history that he gives here. Dwelling in the foreign land, bondage 400 years, God is going to judge up, he's going to raise an oppressor. Eventually they're going to come out of the land, they're going to serve God. And God would give them this covenant of circumcision, and it's going to flow through Abraham, then Isaac, then Jacob, and ultimately to the 12 patriarchs. And so really what maybe I need to reword the question a little bit, but the idea behind this is it's going to come through inheritance. He's going to give him an inheritance, and we're going to make sure that God, look at what he says there. And bring them into bondage. This is verse 6. But God spoke in this way that his descendants would dwell in a foreign land, and that they would bring them into bondage and oppress them 400 years. And the nation to whom they will be in bondage, I will judge, said God. So that's God is going to judge the nation that has held them captive. And we know that that was who? Egypt. And God judged them through what? The plagues. Okay, very good. And the nation to whom they will be in bondage, I will judge, says God. And after that, they shall come out and serve me in this place. So the ultimate be-all answer that I'm looking for, and I'm sorry if my question was a little ambiguous, was that God is gonna allow them to be taken into this bondage, but then he's gonna free them, bring them into this land, and say, this is what was intended for you. Not 400 years of bondage, not all the stuff that was before, but this land in which you now dwell. Christy, did you have? I can't hear you.
Sorry, but you put the answer in the question, so we're trying to come up with something other than the inheritance.
Okay, and again, when I write the question, it's crystal clear in my brain. So we can work on that, and maybe somebody put an asterisk on that, and maybe I'll figure out how to reword that a little differently. But the point is, we've got, and he gives that history to tell them, I'm going to bring you in. It's going to be the hand of God that's going to bring them in. And ultimately, it is God's hand that brings them into the land, isn't it? All right. So that takes us then to the section on Egyptian slavery. List the ways that God showed favor to Joseph while he was in the land of Egypt. Said he gave him some things and he made him some things. What did he give him?
Wisdom,
Okay, he gave him wisdom
favor,
and favor in front of who?
Pharaoh.
Okay, why is it important that he has wisdom and favor in front of Pharaoh?
He was the king.
Okay, Pharaoh's the king. Okay. But Dan?
But Pharaoh is king of greatest empire in the world,
Okay.
and that Joseph is favored in that kingdom. Joseph serves God, so this glorifies God.
Okay, so Pharaoh is the king of the most powerful kingdom in its day. And here we see this slave finding favor in the eyes of the king. That is providential. Would a king look at a slave with any kind of would a king even notice a slave typically? No. But God puts him in a place where he not only has favor, but he ends up being in a position of power. But it comes because of his wisdom. He's a wise man. And by the way, in the shortest terms on that, how did Pharaoh profit under Joseph? Just the fastest answer, yeah.
Everything because Joseph sold all the stuff that Pharaoh could have been
Okay,
like
so
his land and their livestock.
he made him wealthy beyond wealthy. He got him land, he got him money, he got him power, he got all those things. Linda, did you have your hand up? Okay, all right. So, yes, Dan.
One verse summary of this, Exodus chapter 9, verse 16.
Exodus 9:16.
But for this purpose, I have raised you up. This is God talking to Pharaoh.
Got it. Okay.
For this purpose, I have raised you up to show you my power so that my name may be proclaimed
Right.
on the earth.
And ultimately, it wasn't about Joseph and it wasn't about Pharaoh. It was about God and God's power being shown. Okay. So very good. So he gave him wisdom and power in front of Pharaoh. And so what did Pharaoh do with Joseph once he recognized that wisdom and favor and he gained that favor? Yes.
Made him the governor.
He made him the governor over what? What?
All his house.
Okay, Egypt and all his house. Right. And you're right. You're 100% right. Why is it important that it says his house? Because ultimately, we look at how the power that he had, Pharaoh, I'm sorry, Joseph had power. The scripture tells us if we go back to those days, the only one who had more power in that house was the Pharaoh himself, wasn't he? And so we recognize the extreme good position that God put Joseph into, ultimately to save God's people, but for the larger purpose even than that of making sure that God is the one who's glorified. All right. So how would Joseph being sold into slavery ultimately benefit Israel? That's the question that I ask from verses 12 to 14. Susan. Okay, protected them from famine.
Follow God. Bless
Okay, so
Yep.
growing in what then? Growing, okay, right. He grew in his own trust for God, and the people grew in their trust for God. Okay, so look at starting in verse 12. It says, when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent out his fathers first, and the second time Joseph was made known to his brothers. And we can go to the whole story about how did Joseph end up in Egypt? He was sold by his brothers. And what was one of my favorite lines of Joseph's, and not lying like a line in a play, but one of my favorite statements that Joseph ever made. He's looking at his brothers, and his brothers are quaking in their boots because they realize they sold him into slavery and he has the power to kill them. Yes, Susan. You intended it for evil, but God intended it for good, to bring it about as it is this day to save Israel. And so as we think about that's exactly the quote that I was thinking of, Susan. And so we recognize that. So this whole thing that so Joseph he's made known to his brothers, and he calls for his he sends and he has his father brought and the relatives, and 75 people come into the land of Egypt. How many left? What's that? No, well, not at this point. Later, when God brings the nation of Israel out of captivity out of Egypt, the scripture records that it was a little over 600,000 who were numbered. The numbered would have been the men who were of fighting age, which means when you take into account women, children, elderly men, boys who were too young to be numbered in the census, most people will tell you can multiply that number from anywhere from 3 to 5. So between 1.8 and 6 million people came out of the land of Egypt. It was a huge 6 million, 3 million. I don't know where I got that number. Between 1.8 and 3 million people came out of the land of Egypt. Massive exodus. Okay. But he said 75 people went in. Jacob went down to Egypt. He died there. And they carried him back to Shechem and buried him in the tomb of Abraham, and the sons of Hamor, and all those kind of things. So it's just this. The ultimate thing is that God blessed Israel as a nation. It was, if you want to think of it this way, Egypt was kind of the birthplace of the nation of Israel. I don't mean it literally because obviously they went out of Canaan into Israel. So yes, the genesis of the people, and I'm not talking about the book of Genesis, but the beginning of the people of Israel was in the land of Canaan. They go to Egypt to survive the famine. They're ultimately end up in captivity. They're delivered from that. And what went in is 75 comes out a massive people. And I think it's very unlikely that a nation could have grown in the way that it did in a period of 400 years without them having been under God's care in captivity. And we know that so. He basically the if you want the simplest answer to this, God blessed his family richly, and when they left Egypt, the nation of Israel was ready to possess the land that became the land of Israel. All right. Why were the bones of the patriarchs taken back to Canaan? It says in verse 16, they carried back to Shechem and laid him in the tomb that Abraham bought for a sum of money from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem. Doesn't say why. Why? Yes.
Because Canaan was the land God had promised.
Okay, so Canaan was the land that God had promised to Abraham. And so even though Abraham isn't dwelling in the land physically because he's now dead, his bones are there. It is his land, and it's there. It's symbolic that way. It's also a very common thing that families it would have been buried with family, and it would have been. It would have been. I remember from my freshman Bible days in college, and I can't remember exactly how Phil said it. Phil Roberts was talking about this very thing, and he talked about the importance of the family bones being together and the traditions and the lineage and all those kind of things. And but yes, it was important to them in so many ways for them to come back into the land. Monique, then Dan.
Said God gave Jacob before he left.
Right.
Genesis 46 is it? Basically, if you're afraid to go to Egypt, I'll go down with you, and I will surely bring you back up again.
Yeah, I'm. You go. You're okay. I'm going to be with you the whole time you're there, and I'll make sure you come out. And we think of the no soldier left behind, if you will. Abraham was not going to be left, even though it was just his bones. Dan, I saw your hand a moment ago.
Yeah, Genesis 50, 25.
Genesis 50, verse 25.
Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones right there.
Yeah, Joseph, it was so very important to him that his bones be taken out that he actually caused his sons to say, you know, promise him, don't leave me here, get me home. Okay.
And it's such a surprising thing for a major leader in Egypt to do.
Yeah.
Because in Egypt, the pattern was that their leaders would build these giant pyramids of themselves and monuments down in Egypt.
Yeah.
So everybody would be able to see their gravestones. And he's going a completely different way.
Right. Very good. All right. Excellent. Very, very good thoughts. All right. The last question on that. That was the last question on that section. We've got a few more minutes. So ultimately, we see Israel being delivered by the hand of Moses. Stephen tells of the fulfillment of God's promise to deliver Israel after the 400-year period. What did Moses think the people would understand about him? In 1725, there's a statement made that answers that question.
God was using him to deliver them.
Okay. He supposed that his brethren would understand that. The question is, did they?
No.
No. Why not? Monique?
It's fine. Didn't understand.
Okay, that's an interesting statement. Maybe Moses didn't really fully understand all of it, you know. Steve, do you? No, okay. All right. Dan.
If a guy is dressed like your slave master, your overseer, you're not likely to trust him, even if he says.
So Moses, being the son of Pharaoh's daughter, would have looked and dressed like what? He would have looked and dressed like an Egyptian. If you ever look at the Egyptian hieroglyphics and some of the history of the Egyptians, heavy use of makeup, very rich garments, very opulent. Moses was not just some little foreigner living in the land. He was the adopted son of the daughter of the king. Okay, what does that make Moses to Pharaoh?
Stepson.
Grandson. Yeah, step grandson. He's gonna think of him almost in a grandfatherly way. Now, I don't know if he would have looked at him that way, because certainly Pharaoh would have known he wasn't an Egyptian, and who knows what is, you know, you really wanted to, you can hardly imagine the conversations between a dad and his daughter. What are you doing? You're adopting. What are you talking about? But she would have had certainly the ability to do it, because being the son of Pharaoh's, the daughter of a Pharaoh, She would have had access to the best nannies and the best nurses and the best of everything that she needed to care for him. She may never even had to change diaper. Who knows? But anyway, but the point is that you know, he had it all. And so they didn't really understand Moses, did they? How do we know that Moses was really chosen by God to deliver them? And then the second part of that question is, how did the people act toward Moses? So let's break them down one at a time. How do we know that Moses was really chosen by God to deliver them?
Did a lot of miraculous things.
Well, there's that. I think you're right. In 735, there's a clue given to us as to yes.
Burning bush.
The burning bush. All right. Moses, whom they rejected, saying, "Who made you a ruler and judge?" is the one God sent to be ruler and deliver by the hand of the angel who appeared to him in the burning bush. Paraphrase it. We don't have a lot of time. Paraphrase. What did God tell Moses at the burning bush? Anybody remember? Take your sandals off. This is holy ground. So he and we know he did that, but then he followed that up with some things. What?
He said, you're the chosen person that's going to lead the people out of Egypt. And he's like, no, I can't do it.
Right. I've chosen you. And Moses says, nah, not me. Okay.
If there is some back and forth, then, you know, towards the end of the conversation, God's getting a little bit stern with him. You know, you are the guy. You are going to do this, and I'm going to be with you. And he says, well, he can't talk. So then, you know, he's given Aaron as his mouthpiece, and he really doesn't have any leg to stand on to refute.
Right. So as we think about that, God basically knocks down every peg that he wanted to stand on as far as an excuse was concerned, and let him know this isn't going to be. But yeah, ultimately, God shows Moses you're going to be the one, and the people would have, I'm sure, would have known of that account, that Moses had seen God in the burning bush, and he would have relayed the instructions and those kind of things. So what's that?
God set him up to be the ruler.
Yeah, God put him there. God set him up to be that. Yeah. So, and you did a really good job kind of recounting that story. But basically, he says, you're going to be the one that I'm going to have lead out. So God is the one who chose him, and that's how we know. We have the advantage of being able to read the backstory. You know, some of those people didn't necessarily have all that. All right. How did the people react toward Moses?
They rejected him.
They rejected him. Why would they reject Moses?
Noah.
Okay. Okay. They didn't know him. Did I see a hand over there? No. Okay. Who else have they rejected? Who are they going to reject?
Like a prophet, sir.
They rejected the prophets. They rejected Moses. And they're going to reject Jesus. Does it ever amaze you, and it should, that we have the hope that we have today, that God didn't just throw his hands up in frustration, say, forget it, I'm going to wipe this out and start over?
But Moses pleaded with God not to destroy his people a second time.
Yeah, Moses interceded, yeah, and he said, please don't do it, you know.
And you look at the people rejecting Moses. If Moses was here today, it'd be no different.
No, 100%. Right. By the way, it is just inherent in the nature of people to reject change. And this would have been another one of those changes. All right. That really does put us to the end of our time. So we'll start with verse 37 on Sunday. Let me look here real quick. Sunday's date will be September 6th. So Sunday 9/6.